So I have a talk or lecture tutorial about single particle EM to tell you about. And then I also wanted to show the audience this little program that a new person in the lab in Cambridge called Greg McMullen wrote. And I wasn't quite sure how it would fit into the talk. You know, whether it would be best after I talked about... Actually, you know that pointer you had yesterday? Ah, great. That would be very good. So I thought it would be best just to show you it at the beginning. So during your talk, one of the single particle structures that Peter Rosenthal and actually Sriram Subramaniam, Jacqueline Mill worked on, which is a protein called pyruvate dehydrogenase that Richard Perham in the biochemistry department at Cambridge has worked on for quite a long time. A surface shaded representation of that is shown in that top left panel there. And then that 3D map, which is 200 or 300 pixels cube, exists inside the computer. And this little panel here is pretending to be an entire electron microscope. And I'll just run through a few of the things that it does. But the idea is that three-dimensional object, the map of it, is stored inside the in the computer, and then the program here creates an image as though it was a picture that you'd taken yourself in the electron microscope. And you have all the controls that you might normally use when you're sitting at the electron microscope available to see how your picture changes. So, for example, you can change the magnification here, you can change the voltage, and you're not just limited to 100, 200, 300. You can type in, you know, 10 million volts or whatever you fancy, and it costs nothing. And, you know, spherical aberration and so on. And you can also put this damping factor that I'll talk about later, which is why the images aren't as good as they should be. And then percentage amplitude. So it's all the normal things that affect your electron microscope image. And it also have, I'll show you in a minute, astigmatism and things like that. It doesn't have certain aspects of the electron microscope that don't matter too much. For example, it doesn't have any condenser system. It doesn't have pivot point alignment. It doesn't have six lenses. It just has one lens. It doesn't have pincushion distortion. So it doesn't have a lot of things that you might be interested in, but it has all the main ones that the people who are writing software to determine the structure. So normally you start with your structure, take the pictures, and then you have a computer program system, for example, Spider or Magic or Freeline, to take the images that you get, merge them, find out all the parameters, orientations, and so on, and then you end up with the structure. And so what this one does is it's rather easier. You start with the structure beforehand, which you have to have. And then you can have a look at the images. So it might help you, for example, if you're starting out in EM and you know nothing about it. Let's say you come from biochemistry or so on. So it would have educational value. In telling you about the technical parameters, it's quite useful as well. And then one thing that Greg was interested in, because he came from physics about a year and a half ago and didn't know anything about biology, he's quite interested to use it to make a stack of images that were degraded and affected in all the normal ways that real images are affected. And then the idea was to take those stack of images that whose parameters and deficiencies and defects you know about, and then find out whether indeed the programs that we have do what they claim in order to recover this. So it has a number of uses. And I thought, since he's just done it, be nice to show people about it, and you know, it runs under Windows or Mac or Linux and so on. So the picture that you see there is meant to be the projected image that's the same as the image of the surface shaded view, and it's at a defocus of 5,000 angstroms. So a few of the things that it can do, for example, you can change the defocus to go to be in focus with just a little bit of amplitude contrast. You can go to a very high defocus, 5,000 microns, several microns, up to 10 microns. You get a lot more contrast. And then you see the fringes go right out to the edge of the picture, so you don't want to use too big a defocus. That's a twofold view, the one that we started with. And also you can record various preset things so that it doesn't take you too long to show people in a talk. That would be a threefold view, fivefold view. And then, Greg, also that would be useful to have a support film. So that's added, you know, a carbon film that it looks on. And then you can look at the diffraction pattern that corresponds to that. So in the top left-hand corner now, you see the diffraction pattern. If you go back to the twofold view, you see the twofold diffraction pattern, threefold, fivefold, and so on. And then, you know, you can move it around and rotate it at different angles and see the projection. The program's calculating just what the microscope would see. So it has a variety of uses. If you go back to the support film, you can also add into it something to simulate the fact that your image has got real electrons in it, so it has noise in it. And if you go back and forward between that and no noise, in the top left-hand corner, you can see the diffraction pattern of the pure image. And then with the support film, you see it blots out the high-resolution features and so on. And then the last thing I wanted to show you is if you put in various things like astigmatism, beam tilt, and some differential magnification, you see that the image changes sort of almost imperceptibly. But it's much more distorted, and there are many more things you have to correct for. So if we go to this second panel, you know, you can switch on... let me see. We'll go back here again. Go to this panel in there, and you can see you can switch off things like the beam tilt off and on, and astigmatism off and on. So, you know, it's a tool for doing various things. Now, each of the Fourier components in that picture, so let's say you have a 5 or a 10 angstrom resolution structure of a virus or another molecule with many Fourier components. It's hard to know exactly what's going on. So one of the simulations we thought would be nice to show is we made this one, which is a tiny little piece of graphite. So this is a 50 angstrom diameter piece of graphite, and these are fringes from the graphite that are 3.4 angstroms apart. And we've got it sitting on a sort of carbon film here. If I get the diffraction pattern of that, you can see that we've got a very small amount of defocus. This is about 700 angstroms. And in this top left panel is the diffraction pattern that corresponds to that field of view. So if you then start to change the defocus, you'll see the fringes coming in and out just like they do in the optical diffractometer when you change the defocus like that. So if you go 700, you've got it so that the first zero in the transfer function is beyond, this circle is at 3.4 angstroms. That would be essentially the direct beam in an optical diffraction pattern of that area. This would be the 3.4 angstrom spot, which is a finite size because that's a finite size object. And this would be the first zero. So this is like a Schertzer focused picture. And then if you go to higher defocuses, you can see first, you know, you're making that circle go out, but you're beginning to get a dip. At 1200 angstrom defocuses, you've now got a zero in the transform, and the 3 angstrom peak is in the first maximum. You go further out, and then if you change the defocus linearly, you will see that the fringes gradually move out from the particle until you're out. This is a 2-micron defocus here. And these 3.4 angstrom fringes are the diffraction spot. If you have your carbon particle and the beam comes down it, the 3.4 angstrom diffraction beams come out if you're doing diffraction. The lens catches them, focuses them back. And normally in your in-focus image, those fringes end up back interfering with the coherent wavefront from the direct beam, giving you fringes on the particle. But if you defocus by a lot, the fringes go quite a long way out, so that, for example, at 2,000, 5,000, 3,500, and if you look in the diffraction pattern, you're gradually getting more and more zeros here. So 9,000 angstroms, 14,000, and so on. And it turns out that the the distance that these fringes from the particle move out from the particle correspond to the number of zeros in the diffraction pattern transform that you get. And then if you put in, if we go back, for example, to the original Scherzer focus, where you've got 700 angstroms, and then put in some astigmatism and beam tilt, now you wouldn't have seen anything change in that diffraction pattern there. We've got a certain amount of defocus, which is 700 angstroms, no astigmatism and no beam tilt, and this is the diffraction pattern. And here we put in some astigmatism, and the diffraction pattern doesn't change, but in the image here, you'll see that the fringes are moving. So, and if I go now to look at what we've got, if you switch off the astigmatism, put it from, it's 500 angstroms of astigmatism. So here is the astigmatism box. If you put that off, sorry, off, and you see the pattern, no astigmatism, and it greatly alters the power spectrum here. And you put the beam tilt off, and that alters it again, and alters the image. But if you put them both on, you can see that the power spectrum between with and without beam tilt isn't changing here as I go back and forward here, but the real image is changing. And what that means is you switch that off. You have to be, as you go to higher and higher resolution in these image processing of images, and all this is done in the 2D crystal image processing, but many of these things are not yet done in anybody's image processing for single particles. So astigmatism, most people try to avoid, and they just put in a defocus correction. Beam tilt, people aren't correcting for either. And then the final one, which I mentioned, was this differential magnification. Most electron microscopes haven't got the same magnification all around. So you need to look at all those parameters. And so looking forward on the single particle work, there's a lot of things that need to be done. And this is a little tool to help people to know what's important and see whether it affects their particular structures. Okay, so that's taken a little bit of the talk. If I put those away and then start on the talk proper. Yes, Greg has now, he's been doing it for the last few months, and he's now, he thinks, you know, as of about a week ago, he isn't going to do anything more to it. But, you know, he can add other things later. Anyway, it seems to work. Well, no, I think at the moment, we have it on running on all our Linux and on Mac and on Windows. So I think the best thing, he's actually coming to this meeting that I'm going to on Saturday. But after he's back, you can email him, I'll tell you the email, and then he'll send you. Or you can copy the I have a Mac executable here. But I think it could be, I think, and also, I only have two maps in my computer, which is this pyruvate dehydrogenase complex and a piece of graphite. But you could imagine, you know, you had 100 structures that you might want to look at. What does it transform? What does it look like when you turn it around and so on? So I think it might be useful for others. Okay, so this is meant to now carry on from yesterday. And the idea is today I was going to talk about... I wasn't quite sure how to do this. And I thought in the end the best thing would be to take a slightly historical approach. About single particle electron microscopy. These are the two panels I mentioned yesterday. This is hepatitis B that Tony Crowther and Bettina Botcher worked on. And this is originally just one little protein subunit from a group in Latvia that Nikolai Kisilev brought to Cambridge about 10 years ago. And then this is Joachim Frank's work. So this idea of cryomicroscopy, rapidly freezing your specimens, began about 1982 or so, when Jacques Dubochet and a group of people at EMBL had been working for years, actually, studying how water froze. And there was a change of regime then, as John Kendrew, who was the director of EMBL, was replaced by Leonard Phillipson, and they decided to have a bit of a clean-out. And amongst the people they decided were perhaps redundant to their requirements were the two people who worked on Drosophila, which is Eric Wieshaus and Christian Nusslein Volhard. And they were specially selected, of course, because they're the only ones who won a Nobel Prize. They were the first to go. And then Dubochet, who'd been piddling around freezing water and ice, he was decided they would also, you know, surplus to requirements. But then Jacques had the brilliant idea of taking a picture of adenovirus frozen in ice. And of course, Leonard Phillipson had worked on adenovirus for decades, and so he was immediately reprieved. And this picture was the one that appeared in their article in Nature in 1984, showing for the first time that you could freeze these thin films, that the ice didn't go into cubic or hexagonal, but it was amorphous ice. And then Jacques stayed there for another year or two before he eventually decided that he was going to go to Lausanne anyway. He's obviously not entirely supported. But others have gone on. Not Jacques didn't really get involved in the image processing, but others, Roger Burnett, Steve Fuller, Phoebe Stewart and so on, have done a great job in analysing adeno in various forms subsequently. And then this method of rapid freezing of either individual small molecules or filaments or complexes has really caught on in a big way, and I don't know how many people use this now worldwide, but it must be, you know, a large number. And obviously here we've got a prime focus in this. So I thought it was good to remind people that before that nobody else was doing it. I mean, the cold stages were primitive, but they managed with really pretty old-fashioned equipment. And then I think probably 10 years ago was when people, perhaps when the field emission guns came in, it started to take off. Prior to that, actually, Tony Crowther, and actually John Berryman, I think, was also involved in this work. Tony Crowther, many years before rapid freezing in ice existed, had worked on icosahedral viruses and developed a number of computer programs for doing 3D reconstructions of that, which others have taken and used in different ways. They developed subsequently. But Tony and Bettina Botcher, who was a postdoc in the lab with Tony, began their work in electron microscopy about 10 years ago. And this is a hepatitis B preparation, a hepatitis B core protein, not full length even, expressed in E. coli. And what they found was a variety of particles when they purified it out. Small ones, large ones that looked empty, small ones and large ones that looked full. And they began some work on these cryospecimens and found that they could get separating the small and large ones into T equals 3 and T equals 4 surface lattices, but with very low resolution, sort of 30 or 40 angstroms. And then Bettina decided that she was going to try and do this at somewhat better resolution. And by then we had acquired a Hitachi HF2000 field emission higher voltage microscope. And this is one of the earliest pictures taken on that. This is taken by Bettina with a field of view. And by then also, Sam Wynne had altered the construction so that you got largely T equals 4 particles rather than this mixture. So they were able to get quite a large field of view. There's still some damaged ones, you see, but largely homogeneous. And then put 6,000 of these together using Tony Crowther's icosahedral reconstruction programs. This would be one micrograph with 200 particles from one micrograph. And because of the defocus and the coherence and so on, the power of the signal from the different Fourier components have minima near the zeros in the CTS. So you end up with one micrograph of particular. These are the zeros in the defocus, but showing that there's power right out to higher resolution. And with 5 micrographs, but with different defocuses, but with obviously a preponderance of zeros at this position, you still get troughs in it. But as you accumulate more, you get smoother and smoother curves. And actually, Tony and Bettina don't apply their icosahedral symmetry. They only use they leave some of the symmetry open for testing, but eventually when you put all the symmetry in, you get a really quite a high resolution. And this was like about 7 angstrom resolution here. And Bettina was delighted because she really wanted to see, she'd come to the lab and wanted to see helices from single particles. And if you look at that reconstruction then, the spikes have these ridges, which have been slightly sharpened by this application of an inverse B factor. And these are helical regions. If you've got the contour level, you can follow the density corresponding to one of the polypeptides. And they came up with this, from that map alone, without any other information, and the sequence, they came up with this interpretation. I think they may have used biochemical information from antibodies and so on, and a bit of knowledge about where kinks were. But it turned out this was eventually when this was structure was worked out by X-ray crystallography at 3.5 angstrom resolution. This rough interpretation was correct within one or two amino acids. And so this was a good example of how well it looked like you were going to be able to do. And this is now about 7 or 8 years ago, in that you could get maps of high enough resolution that you might be able to do chemical interpretations. So that was, that was the situation when I started personally to have I felt there was a lot of potential in the single particle work, because anything else that people do, usually you have to make a crystal or you have to make a helix, 2D crystal, 3D crystal. You're trying to force the molecule that you're interested in the structure of to do something that it doesn't normally, it may do naturally in the case of, actin or tubulin, but in many cases the molecules are membrane proteins or they're soluble proteins, you're forcing them to crystallize in order to find the structure. If you could develop the method of single particle EM so that you didn't have to do the crystallization, that would be quite a useful step forward. So we decided, and this is in a discussion with Niko Grigoriev about 1995 or 1996, that really we ought to put more of an effort into doing not just icosahedral 3D reconstructions, which Tony Crowther had worked on, the programs were entirely specific for icosahedra. That really we ought to start to work on things with lower symmetry and no symmetry. And so Niko, Niko Grigoriev, who'd come from a physics department in Bristol to work on bacteria rhodopsin with me for about 2 years, he got his own postdoctoral fellowship and started to write some software that was more general. And then we wanted something that had no symmetry at all. And obviously something like the ribosome is ideal, but there are already quite a few groups working on the ribosome. So Niko picked this bovine mitochondrial complex 1, which is a membrane protein that John Walker's group in Cambridge had worked on for a number of years in terms of biochemistry. And therefore they had good preparations worked out. And Niko did this as his own work. So he did some biochemistry, did electron microscopy, wrote the program, and this was the result at about 20 angstroms resolution. And so that was, if you like, the first time anybody in Cambridge had tried to do something, well, that wasn't a helix, that wasn't a icosahedra, or wasn't a two-dimensional crystal. And we thought that, actually, looking ahead, there's a great potential in that area, so we should put more effort into it. At about the same time, Corin Smith, who'd been working with Barbara Pierce on clathrin, also started to do some electron microscopy. And Niko made some minor modifications to change his program, which had no symmetry, to apply symmetry like sixfold or 6-2-2 symmetry, and got this really nice. So these were the first two structures done with Niko's computing and as a collaboration with Corin and Barbara, that turned the interests of the lab into a broader way into cryo-EM. And then I felt we ought to pick a few specimens, and these were the ones that we picked that were going to sort of be broader and challenging. This is this pyruvate dehydrogenase complex that originally David DeRosier in Austin had worked on, but Richard Perriman in Cambridge had worked on. This was Neurospora proton ATP synthase, which is a hexameric structure, which Gene Scarborough, Werner Kulbrandt, and Manfred Auer had worked on, but as 2D crystals. And we picked that because it had, this is icosahedral, C6, and we also picked beta-galactosidase and ferritin. And some of these we haven't really got into a good state yet, but they're examples of things that we were picking to sort of make sure we had a spectrum of different structures for program development. Okay, and I'm just going to skip quickly through. This was this proton ATP synthase, and so this was an example of the philosophy we decided to adopt. And we didn't knew that both Marin van Hiel and Joachim Frank had worked for 10 or 20 years developing really nice software for doing single particle analysis, initially in negative stain, and then moving as cryo became easier to do cryo electron microscopy. And we thought that their two program systems worked rather well, in that as a way of getting started on a project, you could pick the particles, you could do this multivariate statistics, where you're looking for principal components, pick out the underlying features of it, and build up the structure from then. And the philosophy of Niko Grigoriev's approach, this free-aligned program, was that you needed a structure, a 3D structure of some kind to start with, and then you would take the single particle images, fit them to that, and then do a better job, because it was going to do defocus, astigmatism, and all these other parameters, which at that point, none of the pre-existing systems were doing. So the idea would be that you'd start with Spider or Magic to get you going, and then you'd switch over to a system of image processing that would favor all the things you needed to do at high resolution, and then just gradually bootstrap your way up to, and the idea is to reach 3 angstroms, so you can just see the atoms. And this was some work that Hyung Hee did with proteins supplied by Gene Scarborough. This is a field of view of these 600,000 molecular weight proton ATP synthase. Picking particles and doing class sums with IMAGIC picked up a six-fold view, this is without any symmetry being applied, and then some other views that looked like side views of what this would be. And again, we haven't got a rigorous system for going, I don't think, from images to something with the proper symmetry. So at some point, you commit yourself to one symmetry or the other, and then you never quite know whether you made a mistake or not. But hey, Kyung Hee did this and got with IMAGIC a rough structure, which we then used as the reference structure in Free-Align to get a higher resolution structure. And that's basically what we've adopted as our approach. And then the idea now is to sort of do better than this. But that's a sort of, if anyone comes and asks, what should I do with my structure that I want to know, we say, take pictures in ICE, do IMAGIC, then do Free-Align, and then publish a paper. And then, you know, think about it a bit more after that. So here's another one, and at this time in the lab, also Sriram Subramanian, who's now at NIH, but was at Johns Hopkins and had worked on bacteriodopsin with me previously, he came to Cambridge initially on sabbatical, which became a sort of 3.5 year sabbatical, and his wife Jacqueline Milne came originally to work on dictyostelium, but eventually she also thought that perhaps cryo-EM would be a good thing to do. And this next panel is Jacqueline's work, again with material supplied by Richard Parham. This is this pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. I'm not going to tell you anything about the reactions, the biochemistry, that, you know, it's involved in lipid synthesis and so on. But she took these pictures. And you can see it's a big fuzzy thing. They're all different. It's a bit of a mess, really. But quite an interesting structure biochemically. And that top panel is one of these complexes, which is 10 million or so molecular weight. And in the middle, this is just one image, just selected, not from this micrograph, but, she had a few thousand. She did the IMAGIC class sums, and then you refine it, run cycles, and eventually you end up with, as one of the projections, and you can see in the middle, there's a really nice picture of this enzyme 2 catalytic domain, which is one of the three polypeptides, but one the main domain of it. And then there's this fuzzy stuff around the outside. And they've done this in reasonably detailed by taking models for the parts that, whose structures are known by NMR or X-ray and docking them into that structure. And ending up with this sort of overview with the enzyme 2 catalytic domain here, the non-catalytic domain and parts of E1 and E3 if it was there in the outer. So you can see you can get, even in structures that are rather poorly defined biochemically, you can get quite a good and not too time-consuming result. So that was just to give you an overview of how we got to where we're at. In other words, Dubochet created this method of embedding and preserving the specimens. Tony Crowther had been working on icosahedral particles. We thought it would be a good idea to work in a more general way so that you'd be contributing to a system that could work on a variety of specimens. And then we looked at a few different things. And then the main part of the talk today is going to be, I wanted to tell you about the work Peter Rosenthal has been doing, which is on this central core of the pyruvate dehydrase complex. Because the question we were asking is, the pictures we take now in the electron microscope, you freeze your grids, you take them, and nothing that we do to take these cryo-EM pictures is different between taking 2.5 angstrom resolution pictures of bacteria rhodopsin, or these pictures of a variety of complexes, where after processing you may get to 30 angstroms or 20 angstroms, or if you're lucky, to 7 angstroms. So what is it? What is the problem that is preventing this from being a sort of simple foolproof? You turn the handle and you get the structure and you see the atoms. And of course there are many possibilities. And it turns out one of the ones, which is what's addressed here, is how do you know that the particle orientations are correct? And this began actually by, as a side project, where the idea was we would use a pair of tilted images of the same field of view of particles. And originally we just wanted to get the hand right, because in that structure I showed you of hepatitis B, the hepatitis B core protein with Tony Crowther, there was a similar piece of work by Alistair Stevens' group at NIH. They had been working on hepatitis B, the same construction, and they had two papers side by side, probably in the same issue, I don't remember. But one of them had one hand and one of them had the other hand. And it turned out Alistair Stevens' work, by chance, neither of them had actually tried to determine it by doing a tilt paper. But one of them was right and one of them was wrong. And so that picture that I showed you of Tony and Bettina's interpretation of the path of the polypeptide from the 7 angstrom density actually originally was the wrong hand. And so that was corrected once it was done at high resolution. But the idea was to take, you collect data, maybe 5 or 10,000 particle images, and then the last picture you take, just before you switch off the microscope and start computing, you tilt by 10 degrees or 20 degrees and take a second picture of the same field of view. And many people have done this for years. John Finch and Aaron Klug on TMB in the 60s and 70s. Tim Baker from Purdue has a very nice paper with David Belknap where they took a tilt pair and again have a procedure for doing it. So we thought we would do this and it would be quite easy. But it turned out it wasn't, it didn't agree quite as well as we thought. And this turned out to be very useful and tells us a lot about orientations. And I thought, if I go through this, that would be quite useful. So before I come to that, so that's what it's going to be about. But I thought it would be useful to, and these are what the pictures will look like. I thought it would be a useful in this talk, since this is supposed to be single particles, if I gave you what we have in as our mental model for what we're doing in terms of the signal you get from the images and so on. And this picture is supposed to summarize everything about what we're doing in electron cryomicroscopy. And the idea is the red line, the bold red line, represents the average strength of the amplitudes of the Fourier transforms of your particle as a function of resolution. So this is 1 over the resolution squared, low resolution, 10 angstroms, and higher. And the idea is as you go to higher resolution, the structure factors get weaker. And there are, over many years, many of the crystallographers, Wilson statistics, for example, claims to predict, and it's a good theory, what the amplitude of the structure factors of a particular structure are. And that horizontal black line is basically the sort of this Wilson statistic number, which is that if you've got a structure consisting of n atoms, identical atoms, if they're randomly spaced in real space, then the average structure factor is proportional to the square root of that number. So this is root n, the number of atoms. And that's because the atoms add randomly, and it's just like an incoherent mixture. Whereas if you go to low resolution, and you've got a single particle, at low enough resolution, all the atoms of that particle are scattering coherently. So at very low resolution, so let's say a few hundred angstroms, the amplitude of the scattering is equal to the number of atoms in the structure, because they're all at a point scattering coherently. Except, of course, you've got solvent. And the 0.28 is the solvent correction. So the idea is that at low resolution, the power of the atomic structure factor, if you like, the integrated density in your image relative to the background, is proportional to the number of atoms. And, of course, you've got carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and they're a bit different. But to a first approximation, you can think of the structure as being made up of all the sort of non-hydrogen atoms. So the sum of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen with a few added in for hydrogen. So this particular structure, pyruvate dehydrogenase that I'm going to tell you about, you can think of it as having about 100,000 atoms in it. So this would be about 100,000, and the square root of that would be 300 or something like that. So there's a big difference between the scattering power at low resolution and the scattering power at high resolution, where everything is scattering together. It becomes almost a constant, and the reason for the fade-out here is that the atoms have a certain form factor. In other words, in X-ray scattering, the electrons are not all at a point, they have a certain size. In electrons, the potential inside the atom has a certain distribution. So that red line is what you expect for the structure factor of your particle. And there's a lot more in this diagram. I'm going to spell out one thing. These horizontal dotted lines are, in any one micrograph of one particle, you're only allowed to give a certain exposure to it before you have radiation damage. That's about 5, 10, 20 electrons per square angstrom. And that means that in your image, if you Fourier transform it, you get a certain amount of noise. And if you have one image, this is the amount of noise you get on that image. If you then take 10 of them and average them, then the noise goes down because the signal averages because it's the same picture you're taken, and you have 10 images, 100, 1,000, and so on. So as you add together these single particle images, the structure is gradually revealed as you drop the noise level. And then the idea is once you've collected enough data, and that might be 1,000, 10,000, or it might be 1,000,000 images, eventually you'll have made the noise level so low that the entire structure from low resolution all the way out to perhaps 3 angstroms will be revealed above the noise level. And that's essentially what the philosophy of what we're doing is. And I may have time at the end, but I may stop to go over what the theory is about how you get the noise level relative to the scattering and so on. The main problem in practice is that although this is the structure factor of the particles that you're imaging, the images you get are not as good as they should be. They're blurred, they've got charging, they're degraded in various ways. And that blurring, is just a sort of blurring factor, it also has a Fourier transform, which causes this bold red line to be reduced. And it's obviously not reduced at low resolution because the blurring is a movement of a certain number of angstroms. And that line there, the sort of top dotted red line, is meant to indicate how the ideal structure factor of your particle is affected by the fact that you've recorded it in EM. You've degraded it in some way. And you have to make up for that by collecting more particle images to get the noise level below that. And then at some point, if you haven't collected enough images, in your image analysis, your structure factor is fading, and if you've collected only 100,000 images, eventually the transform of that average of the image beyond a certain part will just be noise, and therefore you say this is the resolution that you can reach by that particular experiment. And then if your computer program isn't very good either, for example, it didn't find the orientations correctly, then that has a certain uncertainty in the positioning of the image that you've recorded, and that creates another fade out of the particle, so that you have essentially an overall fading out of the power of the transform. It's a combination of what you've lost by recording it in the image and what you've not properly processed in your computer program, causing it to fade even better. And so then you need more particles to reach the same conclusion. And that's a sort of overview of what we think we're doing. Obviously, if you have symmetry, that gives you more views. And we'll come back to that, I hope, right at the end. Okay, so Peter started off, and I have to say this sort of view of what we're doing is something we Peter and I have talked about and developed over the last year or two. And we think it applies to tomography, single particles, helices, and so on. It's a sort of generic view of what the signal-to-noise ratio is, and therefore helps you to decide what you should be doing next to make things better. Anyway, that's a field of view of this particular pyruvate dehydrogenase enzyme 2 catalytic domain complex. You can see some five-fold views here, some two-fold views, possibly nearly three-fold views. So we go through the normal procedure. You pick out a few thousand particle images. We use a MAGIC to get a starting model, and then we use that reference to then get more accurate orientations, defocus, and so on, and get a better model. And then the question is, how good is that model? And the original question was, what is the hand of the model? So what Peter did was to take a few micrographs, but actually this is all from one micrograph. These are 10 particle images from the first picture of a field of view. So that's a particular particle, and then it was tilted by a certain angle, 10 degrees. So this picture here is the same particle tilted by 10 degrees. And you can see that's probably not such a good one, but here is one that looks almost like a threefold axis. And you tilt it and it looks more like a twofold axis. And there's a sort of certain distance between those. These are the actual raw images, and this is the back projection from that model whose orientation is thought to correspond to that particular image by the computer program that has searched for all the angles. And the idea was, that we had, was to use this program pre-aligned that Niko Grigoriev had written. The original idea was to take perhaps 50 images, find the orientations of the 50 images and write them out, take the second micrograph, which of course is partly radiation damaged by them, but might have enough information to find the orientations still, write out a second file with the orientations of that, and then have a little jiffy program that just reads in two files, compares the orientation angles, and tells you the hand. And when we did that, it didn't work at all. And we thought that the problem was that the program might have a bug in it or something like that. But it turned out that wasn't right. And the problem was that the orientations that we were getting, and you know, they weren't bad orientations. We got a model. If we hadn't been more analytical about it, we would have published our paper and been happy. And indeed, reading literature, that's what most people are doing at the moment. They do the work, they get a structure, they look at it, they think it's a nice structure, they publish it, and it's fine. And you can't say there's anything wrong with it, because there aren't proper analytical tools for doing that. Anyway, so we did that, and found the orientations, and they didn't really agree properly, and I'll come back to tell you why in a moment. So we had to do something better. So what we did was to take the orientations from the first micrograph, and since we knew the tilt axis and the tilt angle, we would predict what the orientations on the second micrograph, this is the radiation damaged one, were. And we would ask, what is the phase residual or the R factor? And that's what Belknap and Baker had done about 10 years earlier. But rather than just doing it at plus 10 and minus 10 degrees, which would have told you the hand, we thought actually it would be good to plot a map of that. And on the left was not the first map we got, because that was not nearly so good. But the idea of this map then is that in the middle, that represents the orientations of the 50 particles on the first image, normalized for each particle. And then what we've done is we've taken those 50 particles and tilted them by various angles in various directions. So plus or minus 15 degrees in Y, plus or minus 15 degrees in X, or in different angles. So actually there are 961, I think it is, different predicted angles in sort of 1 degree steps from the first image that have been written out. And then the same program, FreeAlign, reads in those 961 and tells you the phase residual. And what we were looking for, since we knew that in this case the particles had been tilted by exactly 10 degrees, and you can read the goniometer to be 10.05, and in a particular direction, we expected to get a minimum at exactly 10 degrees. So that's 5 degrees. It should be exactly here. And actually, the first time we did it, which I thought I wouldn't show that, too, we got a minimum at about 1 degree. It was really awful. And we thought, well, what can possibly be happening? So we changed various things, the resolution, and so on, eventually got it. This minimum is at about 7 degrees. And it's supposed to be 10 degrees. And the reason for that is that the orientations we've got are, some of them are very good. You've got the particle with the right orientation, and therefore it would predict correctly when you change it by 10 degrees where the particle on the second image would be. But some of them are just complete rubbish. So they don't help, they don't contribute in any way, yet it is a minimum that you've found. And the second micrograph, let's say it's a piece of dirt on it, ice contamination or something like that. That then tends to make it give another minimum also at the zero position. So anyway, using this, we then said, okay, well, we know it should be at 10 degrees, so we'll change the resolution, we'll change the weighting, we'll change our algorithms to try and get better orientation parameters. And once we did all of them, we got the picture that's shown on the right. So this has the minimum, in fact, it's slightly beyond 10.2 degrees, and exactly in the right direction. And Peter's done this for 5 degrees, 20 degrees, lots of different micrographs. And so now we know that the program works, the system works, but the orientations that we thought were really good orientations and we'd been using in our approach previously turned out to be not very good orientations. And another way of looking at that, this is an example of what were the parameters that we varied to get better orientations. One was the defocus we thought we had might have been different by 1,000 angstroms. Another one was, this is a sort of weighting factor, it's called the refinement temperature, between low resolution and high resolution. And obviously if you give too much weight to high resolution, you get a worse fit, and too much weight at low resolution you get, but there's an optimum. But this is the one I wanted to show you. So this was the plot we got. So there are 50 symbols plotted here. And this is the original experiment where you get an orientation from the particle on the first film, you get an orientation from the particle on the second film, and you ask what tilt angle and tilt axis would give you that. And that's what's plotted here. And they should all be around 10 degrees, as you'll see on the right-hand side. And what you can see here is that there is a bit of clustering at 10 degrees, but there are lots and lots of them wrong. So we thought perhaps in this original run, maybe only a third of them were good orientations. But by the once we'd optimized the parameters, almost all of them are clustering at the 10 degrees in the right direction. There are a few that are wrong, 2, 4, 6, 8 or so. And it turns out when you look at these in more detail, the ones that are, because this is comparing two micrographs, an untilted and a tilted, a low dose and one that's been a bit damaged. These orientations here are all ones that are completely wrong on the second micrograph. So it turned out that once you've optimized the right resolution, the right weighting, all of the parameters that the different programs allow you to do, if we were to have done this using SPIDER and Imagic, we would be using different parameters like the low pass and the high pass resolution, and they'll have other parameters. So there's nothing about FreeAlign this procedure it limits it to. It could be done with any other computer programming system. It's the idea of using the second micrograph to judge how well you're doing from the first one. So then if you look at that clustering, if you ignore the ones that are obviously wrong and from the second micrograph, you find out that the error in your orientation is actually about 2.5 degrees. It's really not a good number. But of course, part of that comes from error on the first micrograph. Part of it comes from error on the second micrograph, which is more damaged. And so we actually think the error from the orientations on the first micrograph, which is the one you'd normally be using for your structure, is about 1.5 degrees. And obviously, a 1.5 degree, if you've got a particle of 250 angstroms in diameter, a 1.5 degree uncertainty in its position is blurring the outer features by several angstroms, 3 angstroms, 4 angstroms. And so part of the limitation in the resolution isn't coming from the fact that your images are bad. Part of it is coming from the fact, even in this optimized situation, is coming from the fact that you're not getting your orientations accurate enough. And so what we think, this is a method then of measuring in an objective way how well you're doing, in a way that wasn't being done before. Okay, so I'm going to skip a couple of other things. So having got this then, having got the orientations as good as we can, we can't do any better with the current program and with the current images, we don't think. The question is, how should you then calculate the map? And I think I should probably, this is a little bit of mathematics. The idea being, maybe if I go a bit further ahead. If you then do what most people are doing with single particles, you divide your data into two sets and do a cross-correlation function, you get this Fourier shell correlation, which Joachim Frank and Marin van Heel have been using for quite a long time. So this is low resolution, you have 100% correlation. It falls to 50%, and many people would say this is an 11 angstrom resolution structure, and then it fades to nothing, provided there's no data out there, and it's lost its information. So the question is that a good way of estimating your accuracy? And the idea back in this calculation is to say, well, the cross-correlation between the two halves of the data we call C-test here. And when that is 50%, you're comparing the two halves of a data set, each of which has a lot of error in it. If you were to merge the data into one data set, which is usually what people publish, and ask what is the error in that compared to a perfect structure, if you could get one, that's what this second calculation is. So that's cross-correlation between a perfect reference and all of the data. And the only difference between that is here, you have a cross-correlation between signal plus noise in one half and signal plus noise in the other half of the data. Whereas down here, we've got no noise in one half and half as much noise in the other half because we've averaged two of them. And the relationship between the two are that this cross-correlation against a perfect reference compared to the cross-correlation between the two halves is this formula here. The square root of 2c over 1 plus c. And so what we've done then is to take this curve here, which is the cross-correlation, the Fourier shell correlation, or C-test, and convert each of the numbers using this formula to give you that curve, which is cross-correlation against a perfect reference. And what we're saying is that this curve here is largely equivalent to what the X-ray crystallographers use when judging their structures, and is equivalent to the figure of merit. So in other words, when that is 50%, when C-ref is 50%, that means you've got half signal and half noise in your total data set. Whereas the cross-correlation in this two halves corresponding to that 50% is actually 0.15, it's only 15%. And so the resolution, the reason that the EM maps look so lovely and smooth and error-free is that in many cases people have been saying they've got an 11 angstrom map, whereas actually if it was comparable with an X-ray crystallographic statement of resolution, it would correspond in this case to about 8.7 angstroms. And then this formula is good in another way. Not only does it tell you, roughly speaking, what resolution you've reached, but this is also the formula you ought to be using to weight your structure, to get rid of noise at high resolution. And the reason that you need to do that is that if we go back now and look at this curve, this is an experimental plot of the thing that I showed you at the beginning. This red line is the average value of the structure factor in the real structure you've determined from real images versus resolution squared here. So it fades down like this, and at a certain resolution it becomes constant because that's limited by the noise in the structure. And then what we've done is to multiply that curve by this square root of 2f shell correlation over 1 plus shell correlation here, which gives you that red line. So the thin red line is a measurement of how the amplitudes fade as a function of resolution, excluding the noise in the structure. This is only the signal. And you can see it's more or less a straight line, apart from the low resolution, where you're looking at the molecular envelope versus the solvent. And the slope of that line, in this case, for this structure, corresponds to a temperature factor of about 1,000. And what most people in X-ray crystallography, they have 20, 30, or 50 in a really bad case. So these EM images are really bad. They have B factors of 500 or 1,000. Okay, so what the idea is that rather than having an EM model that's very smooth and very round and very low resolution, we ought to be restoring these high resolution Fourier components that have been measured accurately, but they've got very low power because they've been blurred and made very weak, by sharpening the structure by the inverse of that temperature factor of about 1,000. The only problem with doing that, of course, you sharpen the noise as well. And again, that's where this function, which damps down the noise at high resolution. So that's why, our idea then was that you should correct the structure once you've calculated it straight from the images by this overall factor, which is the sharpening with a B factor like this, and then a damping factor to take care of the signal to noise. And that was what it was in one of these pictures that we skipped. This is sort of the raw map that you get from the EM data. This is what would happen if you sharpened it with a B factor of 1,000. But, of course, you then get noise at high resolution. But if you put in the damping factor, which is this square root of 2c over 1 plus c, you get the proper structure. And if you then take that and contour it at a lower level, and that's, you know, and there is actually not in this particular symmetry icosahedral, but there is a structure in a 4-3-2 form of an enzyme 2 catalytic domain from X-ray crystallography from Wim Hol's group. And what Peter has done is superimposed that after applying the appropriate symmetry correction to put it into icosahedral. And you can see all the sausage shapes are corresponding to helices there, which is what you'd be expecting in an 8.7 angstrom resolution structure. Okay, so then I think I'm finished, except for well, I think I'm going to stop there, actually, because, and then if people have any questions, otherwise I'll go on for another half an hour or so. So I'll stop there.